The reading today is on page 493. We're going to be reading Esther chapters 5, 6, and 7. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her,
"What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom."
And Esther said,
"If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king."
Then the king said,
"Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked."
So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther,
"What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled."
Then Esther answered,
"My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said."
And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Then Haman said,
"Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate."
Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then joyfully go with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said,
"What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?"
The king's young men who had attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said,
"Who is in the court?"
Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is here standing in the court." And the king said,
"Let him come in."
So Haman came in, and the king said to him,
"What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?"
And Haman said to himself,
"Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?"
And Haman said to the king,
"For the man whom the king delights to honour, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honour, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour.'"
Then the king said to Haman,
"Hurry! Take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned."
So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him,
"Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor."
Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther,
"What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled."
Then Queen Esther answered,
"If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king."
Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther,
"Who is he and where is he who has dared to do this?"
And Esther said,
"A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman."
Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said,
"Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?"
As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbinah, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, "Moreover, the gallows that Haman had prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high." And the king said,
"Hang him on that."
So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated.
Thank you guys for reading so brilliantly. It's such an amazing story, isn't it? Really good to see you. Welcome to Euston Church. If you're new with us, especially if you're maybe new to London, we're so glad that you've been able to join us and really hope that you'll be able to find a home here among us at Euston Church. There was a man who decided he wanted to adopt a child. It's quite a unique thing, adoption. Some of you will know about it. The parents, by definition, choose in a special way to love someone, to make a child one of their own. This orphanage had baby cots all around the room. Dirty nappy smell lingered. And his eyes fell on one particular child. Not that that child was especially attractive. He was an ugly little rugrat, really. But he was the one. Turned out the kid was from a slave background, and that made this quite a transformation, because the father was a king, and this slave child was now a royal prince. The toddler phase was fun. Dad was there to hold him during his first swimming lesson, first bike ride, but the child grew and hit the teenage phase, began to grumble a lot. Not that he had any reason to. His father had been unbelievably lavish and kind. But eventually, the relationship just became one of convenience for the son. He came home at Christmas, did his duty. No affection, though. Dad felt hurt, even had reasons to be angry, but he never stopped loving his son. And this father was determined that whatever else happened, his family was going to be a real family again. I'm describing the story of God, the Father, and Israel, his son. And that is the kind of relational, intimate language the Bible uses about that relationship. It's what the whole Bible is about, a relationship between God and his people. There are ups and downs. enemies out there, disobedience in here. The one constant, though, is the character of the Father, utterly faithful to his promises, even when he had to punish them, even when he had to send them into exile. See, God had bound himself to Israel deliberately, permanently, and in such a manner that everything that would happen to them ultimately reflected on him. And that's why, if you were here, last week's passage was so shocking. A plan to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews in one day. That makes it a plan to destroy the people of God. To kill them off is to kill his promises off. To annihilate them is to annihilate his very character. Do you know anything about God? Is there anything you love and trust about the way he is revealed in the Bible? For his precious people to be totally wiped off the face of the planet would throw everything you think you know about him into doubt. We said last week the first question for any part of the Bible is, what does this teach us about God? And that's what we're going to think about today. The aim, not that we'll be equipped for some sort of theology exam, or even that we'll be entertained, though we've heard already it's a fun story. The aim is to equip us for a life in exile. If you've been here, you'll remember this story. Esther was written at a time period when God's people were displaced, vulnerable. He is unmentioned in their culture. He seems distant. His promises unsure. Sound familiar? Today's, well, primary application might be to any psychotic evil dictators amongst us. If that is you, welcome, I think. But for the rest of us, which I hope is most of us, this is going to be more fuel to help us survive in a world where it can feel like God is dead. Now, if you haven't been here, this is jumping in the middle of the story. So what I've done is I've put in the middle of the handout a kind of character bio. So if I mention any of these characters' names and you think, who was that one again? I've forgotten. Then you can just have a look at that. And I hope that will remind you where we are. Basically, we have a king who's being manipulated by Haman, his prime minister. Haman, the PM. That's the way to remember who he is. He has a plan to kill all the Jews. Esther's married to the king. She's a Jew. She's planning on confronting the king about this. And she's egged on by her cousin Mordecai, the Jew. So first we're just going to go back over the story. Just enjoy watching deliverance rise. That was the language Mordecai used last time when he assured his cousin Esther that deliverance would rise for the Jews, even after this annihilation order had been given. And we left things on something of a cliffhanger. The book of Esther, its chapters are a bit like a box set DVD. You kind of get to the end of one episode and you have a look at your watch. If it's 24 or whatever you're following, you think, oh, the episode's finished, it's midnight. Go on, one more episode. Let's just watch one more. Well, Esther is like that. It's full of pace. It hooks you in with the drama. A bit more than usual, some of you have been reading ahead each week to see what is going to happen next. When we left it, Esther had resolved she's going to confront the king about evil Haman's plan. Queen Esther hasn't actually told her husband yet that she is a Jew. It didn't seem to come up in their marriage prep. So 5 verse 1. On the third day, 5 verse 1, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne. That sounds harmless enough, but we heard in chapter 4, you can't just walk into the king of Persia's throne room without an appointment, even if you are his wife. If you do, the punishment is death. Quite an extreme way to make sure you avoid interruption, isn't it? You die for coming in without an appointment, unless the king graciously holds out to you the golden scepter. Well, verse 2. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favour in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter. Phew! Means he's in a good mood. Means he still fancies her, by the sounds of it. But that's just a very small first hurdle, which Esther has cleared. Verse 3. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request that shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom?" He doesn't really mean that. It's just something that mad old kings say to express the fact that they feel in a generous mood. Not quite sure what would happen if you actually called his bluff and said, "Okay, I'll have half of your kingdom." Probably reverts to the original plan of having you killed for coming in unannounced. Esther says, "Come to a banquet." He does. But when he puts her on the spot in verse 6, "What do you really want, Esther?" she delays. "Come to another banquet tomorrow. Bring Haman, and then I'll tell you what my request is." Now, this is where the action cuts mainly to Haman, and a little test of who was here last week. Can you remember what they do when, in a Jewish reading of the book of Esther, they get to the name of this character? I'll say his name, and if you were here last week, you know what to do. Haman the Agagite. Well done, this is getting good. You get in at the start of his name. A few of you have caught on to that. You have to drown out the whole of his name with whoops and boos and klaxons, so this is getting better. There's one more twist on the audience participation next week, so come back for that. Bring all your friends. He's the Prime Minister, and all these intimate dinners with the royal family are making him feel very happy. Which it would, wouldn't it? Imagine our Queen rings you up and says, "Come to dinner." You think, what, you mean some big function with 1,000 people? No, no. Just you, me and Prince Philip. Wow, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? Getting to hear Prince Philip's inappropriate jokes all evening, all on your own. But there's one person who always manages to ruin Haman's good mood. Verse 9. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. This is what caused all the problems, you see. Mordecai refuses to bow before Haman. And here he is again, still not bowing before you, Haman. I mean, I know we've now got a plan to exterminate all the Jews, but... Haman needs soothed. So he goes home, gets all his friends and his wife together, verse 11. And he says, "Guys, do you mind if I just spout off for a bit? Talk about how great I am? Tell you about all the things I've done?" It's what you do, isn't it? I mean, nothing makes people feel better than the chance to talk about themselves. He boasts about his money, verse 11, his promotions. And the one I think is quite weird there in verse 11, he boasts about the number of his sons, which I think is a weird thing to boast to your wife about. I think she might remember how many sons that they have. And B, if anyone deserves credit for having them, it probably is her rather than him. "But enough about me," Haman says eventually. "What does everyone else think about me?" And if you're imagining being married to this, don't feel too sorry for the wife. She's as mad as him. Verse 14. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it." It's not quite "calm down, dear, get a good night's sleep." It's, calm down, dear. Build the biggest gallows in the world and let's have him hanged. I think Haman and his wife must have met at evil baddie school. I think that was the place where they fell in love. But it makes things very tense in the story. Haman is now off to see the king for permission to hang Mordecai the Jew. Meanwhile, Esther has delayed in asking for her request. Will that turn out to be a very costly delay? Events are now out of her control. But it just so happens, 6 verse 1, that the king couldn't get sleep that night. The NHS say sleeplessness is caused by stress, underlying health conditions, alcohol or drug misuse. I think from what we know of this king, any or all of those could have been the issue. So he asks them to bring the Book of Memorable Deeds. You see that in 6 verse 1, which sounds a bit dull, doesn't it? But I don't think the aim is that the Chronicles are so boring that he'll fall back to sleep. He's like Haman. He's saying, comfort me by talking to me about me. It's his own memorable deeds that he is interested in. And it just so happens, 6 verse 2, that they flick onto the page about a time when Mordecai the Jew saved the king's life. We heard about that way back in the first week. It seemed like a completely irrelevant detail. Verse 3, and the king said, what honour or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Did we give the guy a knighthood or an MBE or something? Nothing? Oh, well, we should do something. And he sort of flaps about a bit because this king never really does something or knows what to do, so he just flaps around, incapable of acting on his own thought. Is there anyone around who could kind of tell me what to do about this? Verse 4. Oh, Haman just happens to be in the building. Bring him in. He'll know what to do. And verse 6 is brilliant. Chapter 6, verse 6, I think my favourite bit in the whole of the reading. Haman came in and the king said to him, what should be done to the man who the king delights to honour? And we know about Haman's ego. The king's talking about honour in honouring someone. Who must the king want to honour? And this is where you really do have to picture Haman as the pantomime baddie, as he walks over to the side of the stage to have a word with us as the audience. Who would the king choose to honour more than me, children? Wink. And verse 7 just really shows what's on his heart as he spouts off, well, for the king, who the man who the king delights to honour, he's getting excited. Let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king's ridden on, whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man who the king delights to honour, and let them lead him and horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man who the king delights to honour. He's getting overexcited at the thought of it. Don't you feel sorry for him? I think he just wants to be loved. He wants to be the king. That's what you gather from that fantasy that he has just spouted off. But it's all about to go horribly wrong. Great, says the king. Let's do all of that. For Mordecai the Jew, as Haman comes back over to speak to us as the audience. He then has the, well, not the honour, the shame of having to be the one who actually dresses his arch enemy and take him on his lap of honour through the square. It's delicious, isn't it? It's amazing. The momentum has swung against the bad guy and his problems rapidly become terminal. End of chapter 6, he's hurriedly taken to the banquet where the queen finally tells the king that she's a Jew, appeals to him to save her people, and unveils the plotter. Verse 5. Chapter 7 now, verse 5. Then King Ahasuerus said to the Queen Esther, who is he? And where is he who's dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe and enemy. This Wicked Haman. King storms out onto the patio. What's he going to do? There's an irreversible edict already been made by Haman to exterminate the Jews. King walks back in from the patio. Just at the moment that from the angle he's standing at, it looks as if Haman is assaulting the queen. That in itself is grounds for instant dismissal. And then verse 9, this brilliant little cameo. Who was Harbona? What did Harbona have against Haman? Clearly something from the suggestion. Oh, I don't know if it's helpful to mention this at this point, but there just happens to be a really big gallows in Haman's garden. I don't know if it's helpful to mention that at this point. And in terms of the tension of the book, that is the end of the story. We've got some administrative details to sort out next week, but we know it's all going to be all right for the Jews now. 7 verse 10. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he'd taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And that, children, is how it happened. There just happened to be a gallows, and there happened to be a sleepless king, and they just happened to flip to the right page, and the king happened to walk back in at the right moment to speak to his queen, who just so happened to have been raised up to this position for this moment, because she just so happened to be of the same people group as the people who just so happened to end up being saved. What are we learning about God through this? Do you remember we said that was our question? And if you're following on the handout there, we're going to merge points 2 and 3 all together. We'll think about God and at the same time, how is this helping us? Are we right to say that we can learn anything about God from this book, Esther, when his name is never even mentioned? Some of you have come and asked me about that. By the way, I love it when you come and ask me questions and we chat about this further at the end of the meeting. And if you have asked me a question over the last couple of weeks, please write it down. We're going to have a question time next week. And I keep thinking every time one of you asks me a question, that's such a good question. We must have that asked at the question time next Sunday, and I'll have had a bit longer to think about it. You probably get a less garbled answer at that time. It's the text itself which invites us to look for a higher power at work here. Last week we saw they literally roll the dice to decide the dates and the government business in the Persian Empire. That in itself is an invitation for us to ask questions about who or what is really determining these events. Our key verse that Phil led us with at the start of the meeting came from last week's passage, as Mordecai insisted that relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews. How did he know? And here's another hugely suggestive comment in today's reading, probably the most suggestive one in the whole book. It's Haman's wife, 6 verse 13. I skimmed over it, but go back there, 6 verse 13. Last sentence. She says to Haman, if Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. She might be Cruella de Vil, but she is spot on theologically. The Jewish people. If you mess with those people, then you're in trouble. Again, it's still suggestive. It's left hanging in the air for you to think about the Jewish people. Every time their name is mentioned, over 40 times in the whole book, more than any other book in the whole of the Bible, the Jewish people are not just any people group, are they? Could it be that there's a hidden hand at work for them? Theologians sometimes speak of the doctrine of God's providence. That's about his ongoing relationship with the world that he has made, his active involvement in every detail of life. If God is behind this rise and this fall, how many different details does that mean he has been in control of? Well, it means he was in control of the king's original drunkenness and the decision that the king came to sack his wife back in chapter 1. It means he's in control of Esther's looks and the king's liking of those looks. He's in control of all of Esther and Mordecai's decisions that they've taken in the book so far, both dubious and brave decisions. The mood the king happened to be in when Esther went to see him. God's in control of the evil plan to build a gallows, which he then used to kill Haman. God was behind the king's sleeplessness that night. Which page of the book of memorable deeds they happened to turn to, and the exact moment and exact angle at which the king entered the room there at the end, such that he thought Queen Esther was being attacked. And that's just a few of the details. All of that choreographed by God. His name is never mentioned deliberately, because that is how it feels when you live in exile. You don't get a running commentary from the BBC News website about God's latest activities and what it all means. But when you plug this story back into the rest of the Bible, do you know any of these verses? The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Proverbs 16. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wants. Proverbs 21. Psalm 21. Kingship belongs to the Lord. He rules the nations. And Joseph to his brothers in Genesis 50. Very famous verse. You meant evil against me. God meant this for good. How big is your God? How involved is he? Now, I'm aware that those verses and this suggestion of God's providence raises a heap of questions. And again, please write them down. I'd love us to have some of this conversation in the question time next week about God's sovereignty generally and about his relationship with evil events that happens. The Bible's really clear. God doesn't directly cause evil. He doesn't take pleasure in sin that happens. But if it blows your mind how God's involvement in events coordinates with human beings' involvement, then it should blow your mind. And it's not something that I'm going to be able to tie up neatly in a few minutes in a question time next week, because it's about an omniscient mind and an eternal God and a whole tapestry of interconnected events that in the middle of the story we could never work out how they all fit together. We sometimes think God's sovereignty is offensive, I guess because we feel it undermines our role in our lives. We all have a bit of the Haman, a bit of the king in us, don't we? Talk to me about me and what I've achieved. I'm the one that's determined my life, isn't it? Well, his sovereignty is supposed to be a comfort to God's people. And not just the Old Testament Jews. In the New Testament, the language of the Jews becomes applied to the ethnic Jews who trust in Jesus and the Gentiles who trust in Jesus. If you are a Christian, you are now part of this adopted special family of God. if you have a God who is fully invested in you relationally in that way, and you are told that he is also fully in control of all the events in history, then nothing can stop you. As the story of the Bible and church history testifies to, the reason Esther is so precious is that it tells us that God is at work for the good of his people, not just when he's visibly boshing Pharaoh in Egypt and parting the Red Sea. He's at work in the coincidences, the mundane events that didn't seem relevant, the decisions of powerful people who think that they write history. And he's even at work through the dubious choices of his own children, none of which justifies ignoring God or making dubious choices. But just don't assume that you'll ever be able to take a single breath or make a single decision, good or bad, or have a single irrelevant seeming moment in your life which God will not use towards his salvation plan. God seems to have set these as some undisputable principles of history that everything else revolves around. Deliverance will always rise for his people. He's so committed to them. And opposition to his children will always ultimately fail. We live in the middle of the story, though. And it's very hard to see, isn't it, when you live in the middle of the story, how all of that will work out. Life is often very painful and tough in the middle of the story. But some of the details here in Esther are just, well, classic God at work. The way he humbles the proud, that is a speciality of God's rescues in the Bible. The way he completely turns the tables on the fortunes of the people in the story, that's another speciality of his. The way he makes sure his people have a representative in just the right place, an advocate, you might say, to plead their case before the king. There's even a torture device in this story that becomes God's instrument of salvation. His fingerprints. The rescuing God that you know was here. Do you think that's too much reading in? The representative stuff, the gallows being linked to another torture instrument in the Bible? You're allowed to think that it's too much reading in. But you're not allowed to think that if you mean that God couldn't have organized those details, or that he wasn't 100% involved in them. So, how will you look at the world tomorrow morning? Can I recommend no isms? No atheism, just because you have an explanation through cause and effect, doesn't mean that he's not the one directing everything. No polytheism, you know, the idea of different gods. It's not that he's God in Jerusalem and in church, but other things are God in Persia and in your workplace or in the country that you're soon to go back to where it feels like there are hardly any Christians. No dualism, no battle of the equals between good and evil. Wherever evil is in the world, God is there too, using that evil towards his purposes. No deism, that's the God who just kind of winds the world up and then goes away and lets the whole thing unravel. No fatalism, nothing determined by a purposeless force. And no randomism, I don't think that's a word, is it? No randomness, randomness is not an ism, but you know what I mean. All of which is to say, don't make big distinctions actually between natural and supernatural events, or speak of divine intervention or God incidences as if there wasn't divine intervention all the time, or as if every event wasn't a God incident. Don't think about his big plans in a way that is unconnected to how those plans are worked out in all the details. How big is your God? How involved is he? I mentioned North Korea last week. Imagine you're one of those Christians tonight in those prison camps. Could this be helpful? As you look at those guards, just to tell yourself every mood they might be in tonight, every minute of sleep they did or didn't have last night, every neuron of their brain, every executive order that might come from a prison governor under the government of God. Maybe that would be helpful tomorrow morning. Look at your boss or your masters tomorrow morning, not suggesting that they're as bad as North Korean dictators or anything like that. But just look at them, the people you think control your life. Every breath of theirs, every neuron in their brain is under government. Will you see the world this way? When people seem to be the masters, when they don't tolerate the gospel, when you worry that you've ruined everything or that it's all gone wrong, we can feel that, can't we? It's so tough often when you live in the middle of the story. It can be a painful place to be. But can I ask you as we finish, who do you think is running this show? Just because most of London has stopped talking about him, do you think that that means that God's purposes somehow won't be achieved? Do you think he's changed his mind about his precious people, abandoned them? Deliverance will always rise for the people of God in the end. And anyone who tries to overcome him will surely fall.